The right to vote is sacred. I'm not happy when people are denied basic voting rights. But then again, I'm not happy when my favorite political journalists decide to retire. You'll hear both complaints this week on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The partisan battles over voting rights are getting louder.
Democrats tend to worry about people being denied the opportunity to cast a ballot, where Republicans worry about the integrity of the system.
Plus, what happens when you get kidnapped by nuns?
She brought me in with all of these other people to get blessed by the Pope. And I tried to get out, and these nuns didn't want to let me leave.
Veteran journalist Bob Fuss on the stories that made his career memorable. And we revisit Ronald Reagan's triumphant 1984 GOP convention.
In this springtime of hope, some lights seem eternal. America's is.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 90 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. We're on vacation this week. Somebody has to lie on the beach, and it may as well be us. So we're reaching into the archives to bring back some of your favorite interviews. But before we look back into the past, we have a fun announcement for the future. Or, as Dan Quayle might say,
let me just tell you how thrilling it really is, and what a challenge it is, because in 1988, the question is whether we're going to go forward to tomorrow or we're going to go past to the back.
Anyway, starting next month, Neil Conan, that guy from that show, I forget the name, Neil will be joining us the first week of every month from Hawaii for a conversation about politics and stuff. And we hope to resurrect the shtick we used to have on that show, whose name I forget. But don't forget, our contest for you to predict the first Republican presidential candidate to drop out of the race is drawing to a close. Send your guess to contest@politicaljunkie.com. The earliest correct winner not only gets a genuine Nixon's the One button and bumper sticker from 1968, but he or she gets to come on the program and brag about your victory. Deadline is Monday, August 31st. And speaking of deadlines, since I'm on vacation this week, you remember the beach and the sand and the ocean, all that stuff, you have one more week to answer the trivia question. As you may recall, actress Melissa Gilbert, famous for playing Laura Ingalls Wilder on the 1970s TV show Little House on the Prairie, has announced that she will seek the Democratic nomination to take on freshman Michigan Congressman Mike Bishop in 2016. And that inspired our current trivia question. Who was the first star of a television series elected to Congress? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random to get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. We'll see you next week, armed with a new question and a new winner, and possibly a new tan. But this is radio, so how would you know?
Bodies in the sand.
Hillary Clinton has, for the most part, tried to keep her partisanship in check in these early months of her presidential candidacy. But she is very partisan and passionate about at least one issue that clearly separates the two parties: laws and restrictions on voting rights. Since the big Tea Party wave in the 2010 midterm elections, when new Republican governors and state legislatures were elected, there has been a growing number of bills that have put in roadblocks in certain voting procedures. Republicans, who have been pushing these measures, argue that it's the only way to protect against election fraud. Democrats say it's an effort to discourage youth and minority turnout. In what was billed as a major address this summer in Houston at the historically black Texas Southern University, Clinton called for automatic voter registration for every American when they turn 18. And she accused Republicans, mentioning several presidential candidates by name, of deliberately trying to stop certain people from voting. Especially, in her words, quote, people of color, poor people, and young people from one end of our country to the other.
Today, Republicans are systematically and deliberately trying to stop millions of American citizens from voting. What part of democracy are they afraid of? I believe every citizen has the right to vote, and I believe we should do everything we can to make it easier for every citizen to vote.
Republicans responded by calling Clinton's remarks shameless and a blatant attempt to excite her base. The issue of voting rights is one that Doug Chapin is deeply involved in. He's the director of the Program for Excellence in Election Administration at the University of Minnesota. Doug, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken.
Well, the Democrats are arguing that Republicans are making it tougher to vote. Early voting has been cut back. People are required to show valid IDs, right, to present at the polls before they can vote. How widespread is this, and how long has this been going on?
It's fairly widespread, and it's actually been going on for quite some time, even before the 2010 elections. The two parties really do have fundamentally different views of the way elections work. Democrats tend to worry about people being denied the opportunity to cast a ballot, where Republicans worry about the integrity of the system, whether or not people who are voting are actually eligible to do so. And whenever one party or the other has the upper hand, especially in a state and a state legislature, you tend to see legislation like voter ID, citizenship checks for voter registration, limits on early voting that tend to play to that policy focus of the Republican Party. Other states with Democratic majorities, you tend to see franchise expanding opportunities like the new so-called new motor voter or automatic voter registration law in Oregon.
Oregon just passed that, right?
Exactly. And so this is an ongoing push back and forth between the parties. I think it's intensified in recent years because people are more aware of the election process in the wake of the 2000 presidential election. But this is a fight that's going on in many states across the country and has been for several years.
What do you make of the Republican argument that these laws are needed to protect against election fraud?
I believe that they truly think that there are significant levels of fraud across the country. Unfortunately for them, there doesn't appear to be much evidence to support that belief, that time and again we've seen political scientists, court cases, and the like look at individual state or locality elections and really not uncover much in the way of election fraud. So I believe that it's a honestly held belief, but right now we're not seeing as much evidence to back up that belief as maybe the intensity of that feeling would suggest.
And what's the argument against having a valid ID to be able to vote?
Well, the argument against an ID that you hear from Democrats who tend to oppose ID is that there are many people who are eligible to vote who, for whatever reason, don't have it. They're older. They are students who don't have maybe a state driver's license and what have you. And that by imposing what is on its face a neutral ID requirement actually has a discriminatory impact on one or more groups of people like the ones that Secretary Clinton mentioned in her speech.
You mentioned earlier that the Republicans truly believe that this is going to protect the system from voting fraud. What do you make of the Hillary Clinton argument that this is really an attempt by the Republicans to shut out young voters, poor voters, black voters?
I haven't seen much evidence. The flip side of that argument is that in the debates we've seen about voter ID and similar laws across the country, the sort of twin problem, that of mass disenfranchisement, also doesn't necessarily seem to be supported by the evidence. Time and again in these voter ID cases, you would see plaintiffs challenging voter ID laws, but then be unable to present anything other than theoretical evidence that there were one or more voters, real voters with names, who would be disenfranchised by an ID requirement. So I think both sides in many ways overestimate the strength of the evidence on their side with regard to either fraud or disenfranchisement.
It also helps mobilize the base, I guess, if one side could say the other side is cheating and the other side saying they're trying to stifle the vote.
Exactly. And it doesn't surprise me that somebody whose program program is called The Political Junkie would spot that. I think that in many ways, these fights over voter ID or other election laws are really more effective as campaign tools than they are vehicles to improve or change election policy across the country.
One of the proponents of more liberalized voting laws is they call for same-day registration, voter registration. Now, this is theoretical, of course, but could a voter register in different precincts at different times of the day?
It would depend on the system in place. One of the concerns you hear about same-day registration or election day registration in places like Minnesota, for example, is that voters can register by being what's known as vouched for by another voter at the polls. And so people who worry about the fraud effect of election day registration are concerned that a voter could vote in more than one place. Now, the truth of the matter is, unless that person is registering in different names at different addresses at different places, those multiple registrations are going to be caught rather quickly. And even if they're using fraudulent names and registrations, they're probably going to be caught as well. So it's theoretically possible. But most states have some kind of check, either in the form of access to a database or something else at the polls, that they can use to verify both the identity and the eligibility of the voter, either to prevent them from registering if they're ineligible or to flag them as having been ineligible after they've cast a ballot for future reference.
Let me talk a little bit about early voting or early voting. And the reason I ask that question is because in some states, I think that the early voting starts before candidates have had a chance to debate or before candidates have had a chance to spend money on media campaigns, you know, for get out the vote efforts. The earlier you have the vote, I would think the more expensive campaigns become. More money needs to be thrown into campaigns for more advertising to get the attention of these early voters.
You'd think so, but the research tends to show that the people who cast their ballots early, either in person or absentee, tend to be, for want of a better term, less undecided than other voters. They tend to be the people who've already made up their minds and therefore don't need the luxury of extra time until election day. And so one of the things we're seeing many campaigns across the country doing, and we'll see a lot of this, I think, in the 16th cycle, is that campaigns will use early voting as a way to bank, if you will, committed voters to their campaigns early so that they can focus whatever resources they have on persuading just enough undecided or leaners to get them across the finish line on election day. So it isn't necessarily true that you have to persuade all voters the same amount. Many of those early voters are folks who are going to vote for you or against you no matter what you say. And so turning them out before election day actually allows you to focus your resources better on the people who haven't yet made up their minds.
I was going to say, it goes to the argument whether you want to focus on your base or focus on the undecideds. And I guess that's part of the spending calculation at the end of the campaign, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember in the 2008 campaign, after the Wisconsin primary, which was a big primary for then-Senator Obama, he got up and one of the very first things he said after thanking people in Wisconsin for the victories, he reminded voters in Texas that early voting began the next day. So it becomes a way for campaigns to signal to people who are ready to vote for them that go ahead and bank that vote now so that we can focus on convincing other people later.
We mentioned earlier that Oregon has just passed the automatic voter at age 18 registration bill. Are any other states considering that?
You hear talk about it elsewhere. I know that there's been some interest in California from the new Secretary of State, Alex Padilla. What I'm hearing from election officials and others across the country is that there's a little bit of a wait and see. The conditions for automatic voter registration, or what the Oregonians call new motor voter, are really better in that state than just about anywhere else. So you've got a governor who used to be the Secretary of State, right, who's absolutely committed to it succeeding. You've got a statewide database that's been in place for over a decade. And I think folks are going to want to see if Oregon can do it with all of the advantages that accrue to that program before diving into something that big themselves.
I mean, I remember when I first read that Oregon had male-only voting, I always thought that was very sad because I think women should have the right to vote too, don't you think?
Unfortunately, you're not the first person to make that joke, but you're absolutely right.
Wait, I didn't make up that joke? I've been using it for such a long time.
Well, that's all right. If you say it often enough, you can always claim credit.
Bottom line, does one party have a partisan advantage to these kind of election laws?
I don't think so. And even though both sides fight really hard to get the rules the way they'd like them. I think the partisan effect of election laws is vastly overstated. That doesn't mean the two sides don't fight about them. But at the end of the day, I don't think any election law or regulation necessarily favors one party or the other.
Doug Chapin is the director of the Program for Excellence in Election Administration at the University of Minnesota. Doug, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Ken.
A longtime friend of mine, Bob Fuss, ended his career in broadcasting last year and decided to write a book. Its title, Kidnapped by Nuns and Other Stories of a Life on the Radio. Bob has been covering politics and world events for some 40 years. I even have him on one of my cassette mixtapes from 1999.
CBS News, I'm Bob Fuss, live on Capitol Hill, where President Clinton has been found not guilty, ending only the second impeachment trial in American history.
Yes, I have cassette mixtapes. But that's for another day. Bob Fuss, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you, Ken.
Now, I think you and I met in 1989. I came to Capitol Hill with ABC News, and you were with UPI Radio back then?
In 89, I was still with UPI Radio, joined Mutual NBC Radio, both of which are now sadly defunct in 91, and then CBS Radio in 98.
And you're on Political Junkie, which is not defunct yet.
That's right.
But soon.
And
it might be soon.
No.
Okay, but you stayed on Capitol Hill for 23 years.
I did, and that was an awfully long time to cover Congress.
Wow. I mean, first of all, you must have seen a lot, because when you came to Capitol Hill, there were people like Tom Foley, who was the speaker. You had Bob Michael, the Republican leader, and they believed in the institution. A lot has changed since then.
Well, Congress worked then. I mean, they functioned. They would yell at each other. They'd get mad at each other. They'd have, you know, all kinds of fights and political arguments and things like that. But they actually worked. And the atmosphere was so different. I mean, I remember every morning, Tom Foley would bring us into his office in the morning, and no cameras, no microphones, and we would just sit around his office. He'd tell us what was going on the floor that day. He'd answer all of our questions back and forth. And it was just such a different atmosphere.
There are so many stories you've covered that I want to talk about. But first things first, kidnapped by nuns. I mean, we're not talking about Sam and Michelle Nunn, right?
No, I'm talking about, like, real nuns.
Tell me about that.
I was covering the first foreign trip of Pope John Paul II. This was a new thing. Popes didn't do these kinds of international trips where they would travel all over and go in the Pope-mobile and do all this stuff.
And what year is this?
It was to Mexico, and it would have been 1979, I believe. And the Mexican government didn't know how to handle it. The Vatican didn't know how to handle it. It was very chaotic. You know, there was one event I remember where they wouldn't let us in with the credentials that we had. And so a group of us went and walked around and crawled under barbed wire to get into a mass. I mean, it was a crazy thing. And so we were covering a big parade in Mexico City. I was with a group of colleagues. We drove to where we thought we were supposed to be, but we couldn't be sure because of all the chaos. So I stayed with the car, and they went to try to make sure this was where we were going to be. And they were gone a long time, and I was standing outside the car and getting kind of nervous. And a woman comes up to me and looks at my credential and tells me to come with her. And I just assumed that they had gotten in where they were supposed to go but couldn't get back out again, which would have been typical. So I paid off the cab driver and followed her, and we just went through one security checkpoint after another, and we end up in a courtyard. And I look around, and I am surrounded by handicapped Mexicans in wheelchairs, on crutches, with all kinds of disabilities. I myself walk on crutches. It hit me like a ton of bricks. She wasn't sent by my colleagues. She brought me in with all of these other people to get blessed by the Pope. And I panicked. And I thought my colleagues would be looking for me, and I tried to get out. And these nuns didn't want to let me leave and were saying something along the lines of, you idiot, you obviously need to be blessed by the Pope. Where are you going? And I had to kind of push my way out. And I tell you, years later, reporters would come up to me who I'd never met before and said, oh, I know you. I heard the story of when you were kidnapped by nuns in Mexico. So it struck me as a good title for the memoir.
In your book, you talk a lot about the fact that you're on crutches, and you use different words, disabled, crippled, I think you wrote at one point, handicapped. I'm listening to you going under barbed wire and trying to move around. And obviously, when you cover conventions, you're trying to move around the floor, which is impossible to move around if anybody has been on a convention floor. How did you do it? How do you do it?
You know, I was born with birth defects and disabilities, so I learned to walk on crutches. So I never knew any other way of getting around. And so for me, it never struck me that I was limited in any way. I just did whatever I wanted to do, and I just did them with crutches because that's what I had. And that sort of was my approach to life. And, you know, it's not something I'd ever really talked about in my career, and people on the radio had no idea I was on crutches.
No idea, right.
And happily, in the beginning of my career, the people who are hiring me had no idea I was on crutches because they were on the other side of the country and I was freelancing. But I decided in this book it was something that I should talk about because I know in my own life people have come up to me and say, like if I'm skiing, for example, which I like to do, that it somehow has inspired them to try something they couldn't do. And that's a good thing. And I thought it was worth talking about. But to answer directly, as I say, I never let it get in my way. I never thought about it. There were certainly times when I was in difficult circumstances. I mean, I remember once in the Philippines where I was like in a crowd and I suddenly couldn't move and I realized my crutch had gotten caught on the strap of an AK-47. And I thought, that's not a good thing, you know, but it never limited me in terms of the way I look at things. And it's just, you know, just kind of the part of who I am.
We always talk about some event in our lives that made us want to be in this profession or that profession. What made you want to be a journalist?
You know, I never wanted to be a journalist as a kid. It was the last thing in my mind. I'd always wanted to be a lawyer, and I couldn't spell. And so this was before spell check. And so the idea of being a reporter just made no sense to me at all. And so when I went off to college, I wanted to be a lawyer and had every intention of being a lawyer, majored in political science, joined the debate team. This was in 1970 at Stanford University out in California. And it turned out the first friend I made was a guy who lived across the hall in my freshman dorm by the name of Pete Williams, a name people might recognize as an NBC correspondent. And he kept trying to convince me to go to the campus radio station. And I said, you know, I'm busy. I've got this. I've got that. And he said, come on, it's fun. And finally, he convinced me. And I went. And I loved it. And, you know, this was a time of anti-war demonstrations and protests and all kinds of stuff. And we would go on the radio and broadcast live for hours on end, you know, through sit-ins and teach-ins and all kinds of things. And it was so much more exciting than political science. And I kept spending more and more time at the radio station. And after, I guess, about 2 years, I decided, you know, this is what I want to do. And so I gave up the idea of going to law school and just stuck with radio.
At one point in your book, you said you owe your career to Patty Hearst.
There's been a big kidnapping on the West Coast. The victim is Patricia Hearst, the daughter of newspaper executive Randolph Hearst and a granddaughter of the legendary William Randolph Hearst. Richard Threlkeld reports.
Now, you say you owe your career to her. You weren't part of the kidnapping.
No, I wasn't.
Because it didn't mention that in the book.
It didn't.
No.
I would have mentioned it. I had just graduated from college. I was actually the same age as Patty Hearst. And I tried to get a job at a radio station in San Francisco or someplace else in the area. No one would hire me. And so I decided to do freelance work, which is basically covering stories when I can find them and selling them to networks and different stations and hoping that I could break in that way. And Patty Hearst was kidnapped. I was nearby, and I went to the family home that belonged to her father, Randolph Hearst, who is, of course, the son of William Randolph Hearst, the famous publisher. This was a huge story. I mean, was like, you know, after the Lindbergh kidnapping, this was the next biggest kidnapping.
And you covered that too, right?
Somewhere. And so this was huge. And I ended up covering it for UPI Radio, which at that time was a very large radio network. And I was suddenly on the air every day on stations all over the country. And that led eventually to them hiring me. And I actually have a very unusual career path because I never worked at a local radio station other than in college. I started at the network, and so I've basically covered only national news since that time.
You said you weren't part of the kidnapping, but was Lou Geiserman part of the kidnapping?
No. No.
Who the heck is Lou Geiserman?
Lou Geiserman is an extremely talented and wonderful news executive who I worked with and worked for a while at UPI Radio years ago. And he then went on to work at WCBS in New York and Bloomberg and lots of different places. A great guy. But like many managers in radio, he loves man on the street interviews. And reporters hate man-on-the-street interviews. I've never met a reporter yet who doesn't hate.
They're useless.
They're terrible. You walk up to strangers and you say, you know, what do you think about gay marriage? And if they don't hit you, then sometimes
or kiss you.
Right. You know, it's just silly. And it, as far as I'm concerned, it adds nothing to a story. But managers love it. And he loved it more than most. And so when he was leaving to go to another job, we were asked, all of us at different bureaus around the country and around the world who worked for UPI at that time, to do little, you know, recorded vignettes for his going away party, which was going to be in New York. So I decided the best way to do that would be man on the street interviews. And so I just went outside and started asking random people what they thought about Lou Geiserman and got lots of great answers. I heard from Lou, by the way, and he said he liked the book except for that part.
Let me ask you a question about how you do your job. We'll get to specific stories in a moment, but I've never known you to spring gotcha questions on candidates or members of Congress. You always seem maybe not deferential, but certainly respectful. First of all, is that an accurate reading of your style? And two, do you find today's reporters, especially TV, snarky?
Well, I do that because it works. I mean, frankly, you know, it wasn't because I necessarily respected all these politicians I was talking to, but it works. You get better answers. You get better product if you politely ask people questions than if you come up to them and start asking them nasty questions, because the natural human response to that is to be defensive and not say much. And so what happens, a lot of TV reporters especially, they like to be seen on camera being tough. So they're asking questions not to get an answer, but to look good in asking them. Well, I never was going to use myself asking the questions on the radio. I mean, I was doing commercial radio. Our pieces were 30, 35 seconds long. I was looking for the answer. And so I was never trying to, you know, impress anybody with my toughness. And so I would always start out in any interview with pretty easy, nice questions. And if there were tough questions to ask, and sometimes there were.
Like, who is Lou Geiserman?
I'd wait until the interview subject was a little more relaxed. And then there'd be a better chance of getting a good answer. Because one of the faults of a lot of journalists, I think, is making the story about themselves. The story was never about me. And so it's not my position to try to stand out asking questions. It's my position to try to get good answers so people listening on the radio can understand what a politician thinks, what a politician is likely to do, or what happened in a certain event.
Not everything you covered was campaign related. There were these two terrible incidents from 1978 that hit San Francisco very hard. First, the murder of Congressman Leo Ryan by members of Jim Jones' People's Temple in Guyana. Tell us about that.
That was a horrible thing.
Horrible.
And one of the reasons I sort of put that in this and the other one, which was the assassination of Mayor George Moscone and Harvey Milk, who is a member of the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco. That happened just a week later.
Right.
Together is that I love San Francisco. It's a great city. And that was a time when that city just was reeling and people just couldn't figure out what was going on with it. The People's Temple was a group that had started in San Francisco. It wasn't considered a cult at the beginning. It was a very popular church in San Francisco, and it got more and more people involved, and then it became more and more cult-like, and its leader moved them all to Guyana in South America. And there were these rumors that they were being held against their will. And so Congressman Ryan and others went down to visit. They found out that indeed that was the case, that they were being held against their will. They found some people who wanted to leave. They all met at the airport. And then, you know, Jim Jones' people came and started shooting and killed congressmen and killed others. And then
an NBC newsman, I remember, right?
And that's right. And then they, you know, by the time authorities got to the compound, everybody was dead. And they basically
hundreds.
Yeah, I think it was 900, yeah. Something like that. All, you know, and they all drank poison and they all, you know, killed their children. And it was just horrendous. And, you know, the questions came back in San Francisco because, you know, a lot of the power structure in San Francisco initially had been very supportive of Jim Jones' organization. And so there was all these questions. And then a week later, you had this crazy thing where a member, Dan White, who'd been on the city council or the board of supervisors, had decided to quit his job because he was having money problems, then decided he wanted his job back. And Mayor Moscone decided not to appoint him back and to appoint somebody else. And he came in and he assassinated Moscone. And then he killed Harvey Milk, who is the only gay supervisor and the first, I think, gay office holder of any kind, openly gay, in the U.S. And it was just, again, this inexplicable, horrible thing. And I just remember being in San Francisco that night and just thinking, you know, what has happened here? And then the next few days, I was on the phone with radio stations all around the country because it was my job. And every one of them would ask me, what's gone wrong in that city? Why are people so crazy there? And I'd say, I don't know. And it took them a while. I mean, it really took that city a while to recover from those incidents.
You were also, I think you were in the Philippines in 1986 during, I guess, the Marcos era, where there was another political assassination.
Right. Well, I wasn't there for the assassination, but I was there for the coup that overthrew Marcos. Oh. The assassination was Benigno Aquino, who was an opposition leader. And that assassination triggered an election that the U.S. kind of helped force with his widow, Corazon Aquino, who ran against Marcos. And I covered that election. It had, by the way, one of the great character with the best name of anyone I've ever covered, who was the cardinal, the Catholic cardinal in the Philippines, because it's a very Catholic country. And his name was Jaime Sin, which is a great name for a cardinal. And he also had one of the best quotes ever in a political story, which was a group of us asked him, well, who should people vote for? What is your view on this? And he said, you know, as a church leader, I can't take sides between Ferdinand Marcos, this brutal dictator, and Corazon Aquino, whose husband had been murdered by him. And he said, I can't take sides, but I will tell you this is a battle between good and evil, which was also great.
Without mentioning names.
Right. And so, yeah, I covered that election, which Marcos stole. And then there was a coup not long after that, and I was there for the coup. And it was an extraordinary thing because it was basically done with what was called people power. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people, civilians, just went into the streets. And it was a bloodless revolution. And Marcos eventually left and was taken out by the U.S. because the U.S. had been supporting him because he didn't like communists. And that was a pretty common thing during that era, yeah. When the U.S. supported dictators around the world simply because they didn't like the Russians.
You also, I mean, going through your book, I see you also covered sports. Now, you also write that you don't like sports.
I'm not a big fan.
Okay.
I enjoy watching sports. Okay, I enjoy taking part in sports, watching sports in person. Sports on television has never really, you know, been my thing. But because I covered everything that was national news, I ended up covering Super Bowls and World Series and boxing matches and golf tournaments and all the rest, and two Olympics, one summer and one winter. And the Winter Olympics was great because it was great fun, and it was also what convinced me to learn to ski. So I'm glad I covered all those sports stories, but they were never my favorites.
And you also covered the Oscars.
Many times. 15 Academy Award shows.
Do you have a favorite Oscar story?
The Oscars were very funny because, first of all, they're so important to people. And I was based in Los Angeles for many years as a national correspondent. And so the biggest story of the year was the Academy Awards. Didn't matter what else happened. Everybody wanted to know about the Academy Awards. And so I would go every year, and we'd have to wear a tuxedo to cover the Academy Awards. And I do remember...
Especially when you're on radio. It's
that's right. It is very important. And in 15 years of covering the Academy Awards, I was never in sight of a camera, ever. The people on the red carpet and all of that, I was never anywhere near there. They wouldn't let me anywhere near there. And so, you know, there was one time, and I forget what the reason was, but with a place they were usually holding it was having some kind of problem, and they couldn't hold it there. So they held it at a place, I think it was the Shrine Auditorium, and it didn't have enough room for a press room operation. So they put up a big tent for the press out back and brought the winners back. And then they set up porta-potties for us outside the tent. So here we are in our tuxedos with porta-potties in a tent covering the Oscars. So that might be my favorite Oscar story.
And then, I guess, 1989, is that when you came to D.C.? Or certainly that's when you started covering Congress in Washington. I know we're all cynical about Congress, but did you ever, like, appreciate the giants who roamed the halls of Congress, you know, in years past, the giants who made a big difference in history?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I had great appreciation for the majesty, for the history, for the building. I mean, you know, I remember there were times when there were late night negotiations and I'd be sort of going back and forth between the House and the Senate. And sometimes I'd be all alone in the rotunda of the Capitol. And, you know, it's in the daytime, it's filled with tourists, but sometimes in the middle of the night, it has nobody there. And it was remarkable. And I would just kind of stop for a minute and appreciate the history. And I appreciated the history every time I walked into the building. And, you know, it is an important place, and I always respected that. You know, what happened, you know, one of the chapters in the book is called The Worst Congress Ever, and it's this one, and which it shouldn't surprise anybody. And it is sad that Congress has basically become so dysfunctional. And eventually they'll figure out a way to fix it. Hopefully the voters will get involved in finding a way to fix it because they share some responsibility for it. But right now it is just a dysfunctional place.
Why do you think that's happened?
You know, I think there are a number of reasons. And I think a big part of it, well, I mean, the rise of the Tea Party is the proximate cause. I mean, there were all these times when there were tremendous partisan battles. I mean, you know, when the Democrats and Republicans weren't talking to each other and they're hating each other and there was gridlock, all this stuff, and yelling and screaming at each other about all kinds of things. All through that era that I covered Congress, even at the very worst of it, you know, where they were, you know, the Republicans were impeaching President Clinton for having an affair. I mean, you know, the partisan nastiness never really got much worse than that. Even during that period, the rest of Congress worked. You know, the committees that dealt with foreign affairs and education and veterans, you know, affairs and highways, they did their work in a bipartisan way and things functioned. And when the Tea Party Republicans came in 2011 started, it just stopped functioning. The incredible partisan fights not only were on big issues, you know, controversial issues, but on everything. And so nothing got done. In terms of broader reasons, I mean, I think a big reason has to do with gerrymandering, which is state legislatures changing congressional districts into safe Democratic districts and safe Republican
districts.
They've
always done that. Legislatures have always done that, no?
They have, but I think we've gotten to the point where if you look now, and this is something Democrats, it's good for Democrats to do that. It's good for Republicans to do that. It's horrible for everyone else, because we've gotten to the point now where the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of congressional districts are safe Democratic or safe Republican. So what that means is that if you're a Republican in a safe district, you never have to appeal to moderates. And in fact, you can't even be seen appealing to moderates, because your only threat comes from a Republican more conservative than you in a Republican district.
In the primary.
In the primary. Same thing on the Democratic side. You know, if you're a Democrat in a safe Democratic district, you have to appeal to the most liberal Democrats because they're the ones who vote in the primary. So what's happened, I mean, when I first started covering Congress, when you first started covering Congress, there were a lot of moderates, mm-hmm. and they cut a lot of deals. They've been squeezed out.
Both parties.
I mean, they're just gone. Both parties, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I would be hard-pressed to name a single moderate in the House. The Senate has a few, but not many. And without moderates, you have no way to make deals and compromise and pass legislation. And I think that's been a terrible thing. You know, I'll mention one other thing that is a little thing, but I think has had an impact. And that has to do with simply the way members of Congress live their lives socially. It used to be that most senators, almost all senators, and many members of Congress lived in Washington, in the Washington area. They maintained another residence back home, but they lived here. Their children went to school here. And they saw each other. There was social interaction. You know, I mean, if you're a Democrat or a Republican and your kid plays on the same Little League team as someone in the other party, you're going to get to know them. Well, that's changed. And the vast majority now of members of Congress are commuters. And they're basically, they come to Washington for votes maybe 3 days a week. And the rest of the time, they're back in their states. So they don't meet each other. And, you know, it is very hard to trust someone you don't know. And it's very hard to compromise with someone you don't trust. And so if they're not meeting each other, they're not getting to know each other, it becomes much harder to operate.
You mentioned the Clinton impeachment and then the trial, basically the impeachment in the House and the trial in the Senate, 1998 and 1999, that must have been surreal to cover.
It was. That was such a strange thing. And, you know, it was also sad in a way because, you know, it was all theatrics. I mean, everybody understood going in that the Senate was never going to vote to remove President Clinton from office.
Two-thirds. And needed a two-third
it would
vote.
Need two-thirds. It wasn't ever going to happen. Yeah. And the Republicans didn't want Al Gore to be president anyway. You know, I mean, so it wasn't ever anything real. It was all for political show. And I just thought it was kind of sad. But it was a very strange time and very unpleasant. You know, and one of the things that happened, you know, we were talking a few minutes ago about moderates and how they all disappeared. At that time, there were a group of moderate Democrats and moderate Republicans who came up with a plan in the House to say, okay, instead of impeachment, let us vote to censure President Clinton and say we think what he did was wrong. And they had a clear majority. There was a majority of Democrats and Republicans who would have voted for that because everybody thought what he did was wrong. I mean, you know he's going to say it was right to have an adulterous affair with an intern. That would have been a way to do it without the partisan rancor. And Tom DeLay, who was the whip, but basically running the House at that time, maneuvered to make sure that vote couldn't take place. So the moderate Republicans were put in a position where they either had to vote to impeach or for nothing. And so they voted to impeach. And the last sort of effort at any kind of moderate, reasonable solution went away. And so they had the impeachment, only the second time the House has impeached a president. And they had this trial in the Senate. And of course, he stayed president, as everybody knew he would.
Do you have a memorable story about getting screened by a member of Congress or a press aide or a president? I mean, do you ever, no?
Getting
screamed at.
Screamed at. Well, you know, I never really got screamed at. I mean, they're, you know, politicians and their press secretaries do try to intimidate reporters. And I've certainly had my share of that. I mean, I remember one time, you know, Ari Fleischer, who I had known when he worked on the Hill, but he was President Bush's press secretary for a while.
He worked for Pete Domenici on the Hill, right?
It doesn't matter. He worked for a number of different folks, actually. Okay. And so I remember he called me one time and started screaming at me when he was the White House press secretary because he didn't like what I'd said in a story. And I'm trying to remember, I think it was a welfare bill or something like that. And he said, you know, what you said we're going to propose is wrong. And I said, oh, okay, then what are you going to propose? And so I can't tell you that. And I said, well, Ari, you can't scream at me for saying what I think you're going to do and not tell me what you're going to do. And he said, well, you shouldn't have said that. And I said, well, I'm sorry it made you angry. But, you know, I mean, that is, and I like him, and we generally got along. But there is a lot of intimidation. I mean, there's certainly, at the start of the Iraq War, when I was at the Pentagon, there was a lot of intimidation. I mean, there was a lot of blowback against any reporter who questioned whether there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which, of course, there weren't. But that was a time when, you know, you had to really be tough in terms of standing up to try to report what you knew was right, because there was a lot of effort by that administration to try to get us to report things that weren't right.
Are you going to miss it? I mean, you know, I asked that question not knowing what your answer is going to be, and I know that Congress and the White House are at each other's throats. We've also seen 2 days of coverage of Hillary Clinton where everybody's covering the Chipotle. I mean...
So silly.
It's one of the reasons I think Jon Stewart says, I can't do this any longer. But will you miss it?
Well, it's been almost a year, and I haven't missed it yet. I certainly don't miss Congress. I don't really miss being on the radio and sort of, you know, doing that. And it's nice to kind of come back and talk about the book a little bit, but I don't really miss that. And I'm looking ahead to Iowa and New Hampshire and thinking I'm really glad I'm not going to be there covering that presidential campaign. And so, you know, I guess the answer is no. I don't think I miss it.
Well, we're going to miss you. That is for sure. Bob Fuss was a veteran radio reporter, having spent the past 40 years working for UPI, NBC Mutual, and since 1988, CBS News. He retired last year and has written a memoir, Kidnapped by Nuns and Other Stories of a Life on the Radio. Bob, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Ken.
It's time for This Week in Political History. 31 years ago this week, at the Republican convention in Dallas, President Reagan accepted the nomination by painting the election as a choice between two philosophies.
The choices this year are not just between two different personalities or between two political parties. They're between two different visions of the future, two fundamentally different ways of governing. their government of pessimism, fear, and limits, or ours of hope, confidence, and growth.
The Republican Party may have had its factions in 1984, but it was united. And the ticket of President Reagan and Vice President Bush went on to carry 49 of the 50 states in November, one of the greatest landslides in presidential history. Lewis Gold is currently a visiting distinguished professor of history at Monmouth College and author of The Republicans, A History of the Grand Old Party. Professor Gould, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you.
There's probably no bigger contrast than the political fortunes of the Democratic president in 1980 and the Republican president in 1984.
Yes, Jimmy Carter was beleaguered and eventually beaten, and Reagan was unchallenged and, as you say, would go on to a landslide victory. So the convention was really more a coronation than a deliberation about issues. In fact, it was one of the first conventions as infomercials where nothing was decided, but the candidates were presented.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you had to go through the ritual of renominating Reagan and Bush. And there were economic problems in the country in 1984, just as there were in 1980. But when Reagan addressed the convention, he said his administration kept the promises he made when he was a candidate.
We bring to the American citizens in this election year a record of accomplishment and the promise of continuation. We came together in a national crusade to make America great again and to make a new beginning. Well, now it's all coming together. With our beloved nation at peace, we're in the midst of a springtime of hope for America. Greatness lies ahead of us.
We talk about Bill Clinton being the man from hope, and we talk about Barack Obama representing hope, but if anybody talked about hope, it was Ronald Reagan in 1984.
Yes, it was a very positive campaign, and he, though not much substance, as the Republicans later conceded, they talked about mourning in America and having mastered the threat of the Soviet Union. But in retrospect, it became clear that they might have done more with issues, but they were so intent on reelecting Reagan that the question of getting into arguments was something they wanted to avoid, and largely did.
You could almost make the case they were coasting. I mean, if you think of 1980, I mean, it was more urgent. Reagan had to beat Carter. There was unrest in the country. The Republicans were on the offensive. It almost sounded like in 1984, they were almost just sitting back and letting it happen.
Yes, and they deftly used the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles as the theme of bringing America together, and Reagan, having brought hope and confidence back to the country. And this was the time when the Republicans had the electoral lock and were certain of victory. They had so many states in their column just starting the election that it was never any doubt that Reagan would win.
At the convention, I remember hearing a lot of female voices. Catherine Ortega, who was the U.S. Treasurer, she gave the keynote address. Jean Kirkpatrick, who was the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. and a Democrat, she gave a well-received foreign policy speech. How much of this do you think was a response to the Democrats having Geraldine Ferraro on their ticket?
I think what they were doing was saying, we've got women too, and here they are. Ferraro had stumbled a little out of the gate with her husband's tax problems, and this was a way for the Republicans to show that they were the party of women and that they placed them in positions of real responsibility. So it was a neat one-up on what the Democrats had done.
Matter of fact, if I think back, I remember the headlines back then. There seemed to be more about Ferraro and her husband, John Sicaro, and less about what was happening in Dallas with the Republicans.
Yes, that was a problem. I mean, the press likes conflict and issues of corruption more than a staged coronation. So they covered Reagan, but there really wasn't. It was 3 days of predictable events. And it was more like triumphal procession than it was something where the delegates were not going to argue. I mean, Bush was nominated unanimously, and then they gave up vice presidential roll calls after that. So if you were looking at it from the outside, it was dull. If you were a Republican, it was wonderful. But just for an average audience, the things dragged a bit.
What was the state of the Republican Party in 1984? I know there were Republicans who supported abortion rights and the ERA. Some were talking about more conciliatory foreign policy. But there were really no battles that we saw at the convention.
No, it was the era of, they wouldn't have called themselves the Big Tent, but some of the ideological friction that exists today, they could all rally behind Ronald Reagan and feel comfortable together. later on in the last 30 years, some of the fissures have emerged, and people have looked back and said, maybe we should have talked these out at the convention in 1984, but Reagan and his managers were determined to make it as smooth and harmonious a convention as possible, and they largely succeeded as the result of the election demonstrated.
Another thing I remember about the convention was that for some people it was less about 1984 because Reagan had this huge lead over Walter Mondale, but it was a lot about 1988 and who would succeed Reagan. So I remember Jack Kemp and Vice President Bush and Bob Dole all trying to get attention. I remember Kemp got a huge ovation. There was a lot of talk about 1988 at that convention.
Well, yes, because they knew that Reagan was going to win, so the succession issue in the Republican Party was already there. But in those days, they had it all organized and arranged so that the front runner would emerge from the vice presidency. Now it's much more chaotic, but back then, in the days of their glory, they really managed it with great skill.
When you think of what happened in the 30 years since, you think of more and more factionalism. You think of President George H.W. Bush reneging on his pledge not to raise taxes. So that split the party. You saw conservatives turning against the second President Bush over spending and rising deficits. And then you had the rise of the Tea Party in 2009, 2010 that showed serious splits over taxes and immigration and the role of government. And so the party in 2014 doesn't look that much like it did in 1984.
No, the implicit divisions that were masked at the convention in 1984 have all come to pass. And if you had told Reagan and his advisors that 30 years later, the Democrats would seem to have a lock on the presidency or, you know, a bevy of electoral votes they control going into the election, they would probably have scoffed. And that how that has all happened and how the Republican Party has gone from triumphant to somewhat beleaguered in presidential elections will fascinate historians of political history.
How do you think demographic changes in this country are affecting the party?
Well, I think the salience and importance of the white vote has gradually declined, and the ability of Republicans to get non-white voters, and indeed they seem not to care about non-white voters, has dramatically eroded. And as the country becomes more diverse ethnically and demographically, the Republicans seem quite content to control the House and sometimes the Senate, and then to struggle to get the presidency. I don't know what Ronald Reagan would have said about that, but it's something they need to worry about.
What's your long-term prognosis for the GOP?
Well, I think they better win in 2016, or they because the country is going to become more and more democratic over the next 20 years, and that does not bode well for a national party. They could become, much like the Democrats were at the turn of the century, a regional rump party that can, you know, turn out the solid South, but is in trouble almost everywhere else. I mean, if you try to think of how a Republican candidate could get to the necessary electoral votes in 2016, you'd be hard-pressed to figure it out.
Lou Gould is an expert on the American presidency and Congress. He's the author of many books, including The Republicans, A History of the Grand Old Party. Lou Gould, thanks a lot for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
It was 31 years ago this week that the Republican convention in Dallas, Texas, renominated President Ronald Reagan for a second term.
In this springtime of hope, some lights seem eternal. America's is. Thank you. God bless you, and God bless America.
You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible with support from WAMU here in Washington and is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. For political columns, trivia questions, scuttlebutt puzzles, and bad jokes, and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, check out our website at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or shoot us a message on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Our show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer. A.D. Quigg is our consultant. And Alex Graywinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week.